Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. An estimated 22 American veterans kill themselves every day. And suicide among men and women on active duty hit a record last year at 349. The question is why? What's going on?
One in five veterans of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan have been diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. But some say that term doesn't completely explain their emotional wounds. Consider the case of former Marine Corps Captain Tyler Boudreaux, who served in Iraq.
It's like this accumulation of presence and searching and patrolling and detaining, you know, people who maybe they're guilty, maybe they're not, of bringing them back and putting them in locked rooms or in cages or putting bags over their heads and flex cuffs on their hands and all of these things that we do. This is what occupation looks like, searching this house, searching that house, patrolling through the neighborhoods, questioning people.
When Boudreaux returned home to Massachusetts, he found it difficult to focus. He flew into rages and sank into depression. A doctor said he was suffering from PTSD, but Boudreaux says the diagnosis was incomplete. He says he was also suffering from something called moral injury, which comes from participating in acts that conflict with one's deep moral beliefs.
I'm talking about the guilt one feels when you perpetrate violence against another one, even if it's justified. And yet, just for humanity's sake, you feel some guilt. And this goes on for a couple of years, and then someone comes along and says, moral injury. And I say, oh yeah, that makes so much more sense here. Now we have a way of talking about the moral impact, not strictly the traumatic impact.
Tyler Boudreaux was profiled earlier this week as part of WBUR's series called Moral Injury, An Invisible Wound of War, and we're going to spend some more time right now digging into the subject.
In a moment, we'll hear from Jonathan Shea, the psychiatrist who first came up with the term moral injury. But first, we're joined by a Boston-area veteran. He served in Iraq. He asked that we not use his real name, so we're going to call him Tom. He's 27 years old, and he joins us by phone right now. And Tom, thanks for joining us. We appreciate it.
Happy to be here. Thank you.
And listeners, we'd like to hear from you. Have you heard of this term, moral injury? Does it help explain the alarmingly high rate of suicide among veterans? And what does it say about what we ask, as what we as citizens ask these young men and women to do? We particularly like to hear from other vets. You can call us at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. So, Tom, I want to get a little bit about your story, if you could. You joined the Army when you were 18 years old, and is that correct?
That's correct, yeah. I graduated high school. I had the summer off to myself, and then when I was 18 in the fall, I shipped off for boot camp, and I joined up, yep.
And you ended up in Iraq in 2005. Tell us about where you were stationed and what your role was there.
Well, the first time I was there, there in 2005, 2006, on the very outskirts of Baghdad in some farmland up along the Euphrates River. And the second time was closer to Iskandaria. The first deployment was very different than the second, but our role primarily was to simultaneously, capture, kill, detain insurgents, try to get, security going so that the elections could happen, infrastructure could be built back up, and all the while training the Iraqi army and the Iraqi police as well.
Sure, and tell me a little bit about why you wanted to join.
I was one of those guys. There's always it's kind of a running joke within the Army, but there's always a few per platoon that are kind of hardcore idealists, true believers. I read everything and learned everything I could about the military growing up, and I 100% truly believe that we spread democracy and kill the bad guys, save the good guys, and I really wanted to be part of history and to serve my country, win the badges and the medals and all that stuff. So
sure.
All that stuff kind of wrapped into one.
Sure, Tom. And tell me how that view of what you were doing changed while you were in Iraq experiencing war.
Certainly. I think that the first deployment, without question, is a big reason that I got out. The dichotomy between what we say we go to war for and what we said we went to war in Iraq and Afghanistan for and what actually happened there is so large, it's unbelievable that people don't realize it. I mean, it's a very complex question, but just, a few highlights. For me and some other soldiers, I can't speak for everybody, but for some of us, things that you do in war war are not good things. But what might make it easier, better to deal with is, am I doing this for the right reasons? Is this for the greater good? And when you truly believe in your bones that, you know, based on what you're doing and seeing that you're not, you're making, you know, their land or their society worse, more innocent people are dying, more instability, you know, things are worse and things are not as good as everyone's saying, then that makes it real hard to deal with, you know, civilians dying and stuff like that.
Sure, sure, I understand. Tom, do you mind, can you sort of relate a story from your experience there in Iraq that I guess, you know, that might have made you rethink why you were there or, you know, question the reasons why you were there?
So many come to mind, but I'll just kind of relate a couple. One is kind of many stories pulled into one. Tom Bridgeau, the Marine captain, made such a great point, and you know, all us combat vets, we know the deal. Night after night of raids by helicopter and by Humvee, kicking down doors, you know, hopefully nobody gets banged up or shot. Sometimes they do, but chasing ghosts, you know, just like he said, and he's a captain, so he knows the deal. You know, we rely on this intelligence system that is very fragile. You know, one farmer has a grudge against another and says, you know, yeah, he's an insurgent, he helps the insurgents, and you are massively traumatizing not only the children, the wives, when you tag and bag these guys and you know, destroy the house, but trampling farm fields, you know, so that's just one thing. And another story that I would relate is just that, you know, it's so it was so chaotic there at times, and there's such a gulf between understanding of, you know, the societies, the language, the culture, and sometimes the way that manifests itself is in driving. So sometimes the Iraqis didn't know where they weren't supposed to drive on a canal road or, you know, something like that. So there were times where, and, you know, thank God I missed, but there were times where we tried to, you know, light up cars that, you know, maybe they're trying to run the roadblock as a VBID, but looking back on it, was a couple times where these Iraqis just got lost, and now you're almost killing a whole family in a car because of just miscommunication, you know, just chance like that.
And when you use the term lighting up a car, that means essentially blowing them up, taking them out.
Yeah, and there were guys in my company and platoon who, you know, unfortunately, you know, that happened to. So, you know, sometimes you miss, sometimes you don't, but it's just the massive fog of war, and I go back to my central point, you know, never easy to deal with, but when things like that happen and you really don't believe it's for the right reasons, that's what really makes it hard to deal with, hard to accept, and makes you, as a veteran, very, very angry myself.
Sure. And that's what I was going to ask you about. When you got home and when you began to sort of metabolize, I guess, all of this, what did you feel? You just mentioned anger. Is that the kind of stuff you were dealing with?
Yeah, I think, you know, and like I said, I really want to emphasize, you know, I speak for myself. I'm sure some other vets identify with me, but I don't speak for all. I still have some real good buddies that we had not a falling out, but a really hard time dealing with our different feelings about the military and our different feelings about the war. They're still great buddies, and I would still lay down my life for them. But, you know, so just to say that everyone's experience is unique. But for me, and I think a lot of vets, you know, you get back from, you know, especially deployments in Iraq, Afghanistan, I would say probably minimum 12 months, sometimes 3, 4, 5 years of just decompression. You know, you don't want to talk about it with people. You don't want to deal, you know, you don't want to deal with it. You're still, you know, getting jumpy on the road and jumpy from sounds and whatnot. And for me personally, a guy, a professor I had at UMass Boston, changed my life. He, you know, basically started educating me about, you know, wars, why they're fought, how they're fought, and really connected with me. And I was able to kind of channel that anger, I feel like, into more healthy reflection, able to identify it and to, you know, slowly, it'll be a lifelong process, but come to terms with the fact that, you know, what I participated in, what we did was wrong and not for, you know, greater reasons. I think the jury's out on that, you know, the scholarly, you know, the jury's out on that, but that's okay. And I can, you know, slowly, you know, live the rest of my life, you know, trying to make up for it, not really doing it. But like I said, you know, hopefully go back there someday when it's stable and do some humanitarian work, that kind of thing. You know,
I want to ask you one more question before we bring our next guest in. And that is, some people listening to you might say, you know, you should let yourself off the hook a little bit. You were 18 when you were, you know, you were still a kid. You were following orders. You were doing a job that was set up and organized by your superiors. Not that that should excuse people who do bad things, but I mean, it sounds like you're being awfully hard on yourself.
Yeah, I mentioned it. That's a good question. I mentioned it in the interview on the other story. You know, I think it's the age-old adage, you know, you've got the head and the heart, and, you know, I can intellectualize it all I want and you know, try to say that. And there is a grain of truth to what you're saying, but, you know, only to a certain extent does it make you, you know, feel better. And people that have been over there know, you know, you know, I think, in your bones whether you're doing something, you know, nothing's good. Nothing that you're doing isn't, you know, screwed up, but sometimes it's just dead wrong. And, you know, like I said, it's you can tell yourself that, but you know that there were those few times over there where, you know, the line was crossed, and you should have held yourself to a higher standard, and I certainly feel that way. But, time heals all wounds. I definitely believe that. So.
All right. Well, Tom, stick with us a little bit. I just want to remind listeners, we're talking to Tom. He's a Boston area veteran who served two tours of duty in Iraq, and we're talking about this concept called moral injury. And we're going to turn now to Jonathan Shea. He spent more than 20 years as a psychiatrist at a VA hospital working with veterans who experienced psychological injuries because of war. He's the author of two books on the subject, including Achilles in Vietnam, Combat Trauma, and The Undoing of Character. And Jonathan Shea, welcome to Radio Boston. Thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here.
You are credited with first coining this term, moral injury, decades ago when you were working at the VA clinic in Boston. What does it mean precisely?
I think I find it in the handouts I used at the Amphibious Warfare School at Quantico in 97 or 98. My version of this term, it focuses more on leadership malpractice than on the service member feeling that he or she themselves violated their own morals. But both forms of moral injury are important. One can lead to the other, and they're both profoundly destructive of human flourishing.
I see. And help me out with a definition. We've been sort of defining it in the introduction to this idea, is that people do things that, in the sort of fog of war, that go against their deeply held moral beliefs, and then later struggle to come to terms with what they did.
This is an important phenomenon, and it's happened in every war in history. And you think of 1, 2, and 3, a betrayal of what's right, and I did it in a high-stakes situation. And this has been talked about by philosophers under the heading moral luck, when somebody feels they have no choice, like they have no power to avoid doing a vile thing. And, you know, the terrible thing, like driving in a convoy and you're under strict orders, you don't stop for anybody, anything, ever. And a child runs out in front of your truck and you feel the thump under the tires like a raccoon or a cat. And you know you've killed that child. And people live with that. And there are a million such stories, and it's been discussed by philosophers, as I said, under the heading moral luck. There wasn't anything you really could have done about it reasonably.
And Jonathan Shea, let me ask you about the sort of fundamental difference between, I mean, is there a fundamental difference between what you're describing, moral injury, and PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, the public, the press, and the Congress all use the term PTSD for everything bad that happens in the mind and spirit as a result of going to war. But the strict, narrow definition is really a danger syndrome. It's the persistence into civilian life of those valid adaptations that kept you alive when other people were trying to kill you and doing a damn good job of it. And those really don't work in civilian life, those adaptations.
And I want to bring you back to Tom's story, which I know you've been listening to. Does the emotional trauma that he was describing, is that typical of veterans? Does this strike a familiar chord with you and the kind of work you were doing with veterans around this issue.
Oh, it absolutely does. I have focused on what I think we can improve on, which is taking, again, the 1-2-3 betrayal of what's right by someone who holds legitimate authority in a number three in a high-stakes situation. Now, we can improve the ethical and functional performance of our leadership at every level by a variety of policy and practice and cultural changes. But that gets down into the weeds, and there's not the time to talk about exactly what that would look like.
I want to come back to you, Tom. You mentioned that you found someone to sort of talk this through. Can you give me a sense? Can you give us a sense of what that therapy was like, how you got the help that you needed?
Certainly, real quick, if you wouldn't mind, I just wanted to kind of expand on my own kind of personal definition of, you know, moral injury.
Sure, please do.
Between that and PTSD. So I just wanted to say, you know, like I said, I don't want to be a dead horse. I only speak for myself and in this soldier's perspective. But I can say that there's a spectrum. You know, there are some guys, there's plenty of literature about this. There are some veterans throughout wars that even though they, you know, believe what they did was just, you know, even though they believe that the killing was just, they killed the bad guys, they didn't happen to kill any civilians, it still really hurts them. And then, you know, all the way to the pacifistic. And then, you know, there's this other spectrum. And, you know, from my perspective, it's like, you know, I'm not a pacifist, and I didn't have any moral qualms when something happened over there, and I feel it was out of necessity. But the problem is that, and people have no idea about this, so much of what happens in war, and certainly in Iraq, is not only not necessary to the mission. You can go up and down the level on this, from the tactical level to the strategic to the reasons we're over there to begin with. You know, people are getting hurt, people are dying on both sides, and people are getting traumatized for life, families are getting broken up apart, and it doesn't have to be. It's because of mistakes. It's because of chance. It's because of randomness. And it's all under the umbrella of, you know, a fraudulent war that we shouldn't have been there to begin with. You know, and that manifests itself, just one little example. And a real good friend I had on his third tour, my second, he already had two Purple Hearts. And we go out on a mission, which was basically out of our sector. And the whole purpose was so that some, you know, officers could present a PowerPoint to each other. Didn't really have to be there. And he hits, you know, a 10-year-old IED and gets his legs blown off. And for what? You know, why? And it's that kind of thing that is so hard, as opposed to him, you know, doing that, saving somebody else's life or something like that. It really hurts. And just to answer your original question, for me, it was, you know, me personally, it was a process of, you know, of really coming to terms with the fact that slowly but surely, you know, I could start to learn about, you know, true military history. I could start to learn about reasons for war, how they're fought, you know, reading Basevich, reading Chris Hedges, et cetera. And, you know, letting go of the anger, accepting that it was what it was, and just learning. You know, I was a college student at the time, and that's a very difficult process, and some guys, you know, can't do it, and I almost couldn't do it. But, you know, if you can just let go of that anger and forgive people their ignorance about it and just try to teach them and to spread the message, that can help. And that certainly has been therapeutic for me. You know, not perfect, it's not an end-all, but, you know, it's helping.
Sure. Tom and Jonathan Shea, stand by. I want to invite some listeners into this conversation. Listeners, we're talking about this term, moral injury. Does it help explain what's going on among many of our veterans, and what does it say about what we're asking these young men and women to do? Give us a call, particularly if you're a veteran, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. So let's go to Wayne, who's calling from Somerset. Hi, Wayne. You're on the air.
Hey, guys. I empathize with your situation, being a platoon sergeant in Iraq myself. I also had a higher moral obligation as well. And being with a National Guard unit, and the education level of today's youth is so much higher than it was in World War II and Vietnam, it's very tough to tell someone to do something that they know is not right, or, like you said, they know the mission is just for no other purpose but a PowerPoint presentation.
Yeah.
Well, Wayne, I want to thank you for your call. Jonathan Shea, please.
Yes. The moral injury that so many people experience, first of all, let me say that plain PTSD without any complications rarely leads to suicide or despair or to criminal behavior or to domestic violence. It usually just imposes focal disabilities, like being unable to show up in the open in a crowd. But moral injury is like a wrecking ball in a flourishing life. And in my observation, the road to recovery from it always runs through one's peers, through a service members, a veteran's peers who've been there, done that, seen that. And I really would like myself, even though I have all these degrees after my name, to get people like me off a center stage. We don't belong there. It's the veterans who do the heavy lifting with each other. And I think Tom's description of his experiences bears that out.
Hmm. Well, speaking of hearing from more veterans, let's go to Aaron, who's calling from Marlboro. Hi, Aaron. You're on the air.
Hi, and thank you to all the veterans for your service. I'm currently in the process of joining the military as an officer, and I wanted to ask the current veteran who's speaking, what type of things can I approach to try to avoid mistakes that you saw officers that committed or performed mistakes?
Aaron, what a great question. Tom, can you speak to Aaron's question?
Certainly. Thanks, Aaron. There's a lot I could say. You know, I'll try to keep it short on that one. The best advice I could give you were the best officers I served under were the guys about whether it was a military tactical question or a true moral question. We're willing to sacrifice promotion, willing to stick their necks out, willing to get reamed by command to do the right thing, either do the right thing for their guys or do the right thing for the Iraqis. So many senior enlisted and officers that will check the box, play the game, and do just about anything to advance and not risk their careers. It's such a political game, at the officer level. But what I would say to you is, you sound like you've got a good moral compass. I'm sure that you do, and stay true to it. And, better that you can sleep at night, the rest of your life, or sleep better, than advancing quicker in the ranks. So I would just keep that in mind.
All right, Tom. Thanks. Aaron, thank you so much for your call, and good luck to you. And let's go to Lori, who's calling from Arlington. Hi, Lori. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. So I wanted to raise the question about the spiritual dimension of morality, and particularly whether or not the implied moral authority of clergy, and I use the word implied moral authority, offers anything where clergy, civilian clergy, as well as military clergy, might have anything to offer, or if churches have anything to offer to help people who have had to violate their own sense of what is right and wrong to be able to heal.
Sure.
So that they can experience a depth of forgiveness for themselves.
Lori, it's a great...
for others to ask them to do that kind of
thing. Sure. It's a great question. Let me go first to Tom. And Tom, our time is really ticking down, but let me just ask you if what Lori's put on the table has been helpful to you.
Yes, you're talking about the clergy issue?
Sure.
Yes, it's a great question. Just real quick, what I would say to that is, especially on, bad deployments with, a combat arms unit, the best and the only good chaplain we had, to answer a question, that can be true, but as a clergy member or as a chaplain, you have to be able to transcend your job and your faith. What I mean by that is, don't go out, preaching or in any way judge a guy or care for a guy less because he's an atheist or something like that. I mean, we had a chaplain that would go anywhere into the middle of nowhere where we were, and it didn't matter if you were an atheist or a Christian or whatever. He would just, talk with you and, more kind of like a everything rolled into one, clergyman, therapist, that kind of thing. So those kind of people are the best, and I think that's the best way that, clergy can really help with that. So.
Well, sadly, our time is running out here. There's a lot more we could have talked about. But listeners, this conversation is going to continue at RadioBoston.org. Tom, a 27-year-old veteran who saw two tours of duty in Iraq. He lives in the Boston area. Thanks so much for coming on the show and telling us your story. We appreciate it.
I'm happy to be here. And thank you, Dr. Shea. I appreciate the work that you do with vets.
And that's Jonathan Shea, retired clinical psychiatrist. He now advises the armed forces on prevention of moral injury. Jonathan Shea, thank you indeed.
My pleasure.
And stay with us, listeners. Coming up, he won the race to be the state's newest senator yesterday. So what does Congressman Ed Markey's record in the House tell us about what kind of senator he'll be? Stay with us. I'm Anthony Brooks with Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.